if you went to Starlight last weekend to catch Janelle Monáe. What a show, right? It was amazing, and that was mostly because of Janelle Monáe's artistry and stage presence and effusive love for the people in the audience. But the opening act was also pretty mind-blowing. The Marcus Lewis Big Band combined an 18-piece jazz orchestra with rap, and the rapper on most of the songs was Kadesh Flo, a super charismatic local guy who thousands of people probably saw for the first time that night. He wore a tracksuit, then stripped down to a tank top on a freezing cold October night because he was jumping up and down so much that to him it was hot out. At one point, he finished a rap, then took out a trombone and just wailed. Well, if you were wondering who that guy was, we did an interview with Kadesh Flo back in April. He had a new album out, and he'd recorded the whole thing in a hotel room at a gaming convention. Let's listen back. Hi, Kadesh.
Hey, how's it going?
So tell me about this conference where you recorded an EP in a hotel room.
Yeah, it's called MAGFest. It stands for Music and Gaming Festival. It's the only event that I know of that's simultaneously a music festival and a gaming convention. And I've played at it for the last 3 years, both main stage and some of the smaller performances.
And so you are a musician and a gamer, and I want to start with the music, and then we'll get to the gaming piece of it, okay?
Sure.
I understand you recently left a job at Cerner to pursue music. Tell me about that decision.
So it was actually, I left C2FO, and I was at Cerner before. But basically, when I left Cerner and went to C2FO, it's, you know, Sandy Kipper runs the company. It's very on the up and up, making a lot of global news. You work very hard while you're there, but they have a very flexible vacation policy. That allowed me to build a lot of momentum because I could tour when I needed to tour. I could take a week off to play South by Southwest and network. And just building that kind of created this situation where I was working a lot between music and my job, and I just had to make a decision from a bandwidth standpoint.
And so was that scary to you? I mean, you're part of a local band, The Fantastics.
Yes.
And you've been touring as an independent hip-hop artist as well. That's still a pretty big jump.
Yeah. Yeah, it's huge. It's terrifying. And I think it's something that a lot of artists need to understand. My goal is to be able to manage my schedule more so than necessarily just only be making money off of music. I have a bunch of side hustles, but I need to be able to control that schedule so that I could get in those recording sessions and travel when I need to travel and what have you.
And then, I mean, I guess getting in the recording sessions helps when you have them at a hotel room at a convention.
Yeah, that was really beautiful too. Just a lot of people who I don't see a lot from all different parts of the country, and we're just vibing in a hotel room between shows. People coming in, you know, it's like 3 a.m. and we just left a party that was the after party for a show, and then we're making beats and, you know, drinking a little and just kind of communicating about what we should change and all these other things. It was really gorgeous. The whole moment was amazing.
So tell me more about the gaming community that you're part of.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different facets of music and gaming that intertwine. So I think I got involved in this community, generally the nerdcore community, via Mega Ran, he calls himself a chip hop artist, but he's probably the premier indie hip hop voice in the nerdy scene.
Okay, so nerdcore, nerdy scene. Mm-hmm. What exactly are you talking about?
Music that talks about things that typically are attributed to nerds. Now all of it's more pop culture, which is very interesting.
So, but like nerds, you don't mean that generically.
No. I mean, things related to tech, things related to sci-fi, video games, anime, things that, like I said, at one point were attributed exclusively to nerds, fantasy, but now really is across the board, and it should have been that way the whole time. So it's kind of a genre that has a subgenre of music that's taken ownership of something that was used as an insult, and that scene's really growing.
And you're a part of something called the Nerdy People of Color Collective?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So that was something that Mega Ran founded. He found a bunch of us on the internet, and a lot of us were inspired by him because really there was, before him, there wasn't a person of color who sounded like hip-hop because he's a Philly cat, sounds like, you know, Biggie rapping about video games to an extent. and pulled us all together to include Samus, who's gotten a lot of footage, a lot of coverage, Richie Branson, who's made a lot of noise, and a bunch of people, Xavier Woods in the WWE. We all just link up and started collaborating and doing shows together, and now it's like a family. So we just show up at conventions, at events. We're on each other's albums, and we try to make sure that there's just an open space and network for marginalized people who are in these spaces, because historically they've been pretty white and male, and in a sense gatekept, even though it's supposed to be a safe space for people who are rejected.
So, in what sense gatekept?
Certain things aren't considered nerdy enough. Certain things are considered too black, too
like,
Asian.
Like what?
Rap in general. Like rap that isn't ironic is a great example. Rap that isn't kind of a faux rap. So it's kind of been breaking in because there are people who are, you know, pretty hood who are really into video games, for example, and did not feel like they could be included in these spaces. And what's interesting now is you have people coming through at conventions and openly rapping with video game and anime punchlines, and they're inspired by us the same way that we were inspired by Mega Ran. It's really awesome.
The idea of not being nerdy enough is really funny.
It's hilarious. It's completely absurd.
I wanted to get back to your new EP, Room Service. Let's play a little bit of a couple of different songs. We'll start with Glassy Eyes, which sounds, at first anyway, to me, like a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's listen.
Living this life is amazing, bopping me feeling so wavy. Living this life is amazing, bopping me feeling so wavy. Living this life is amazing, bopping me feeling so wavy. I am not here to be average, every beat that touches rapid. Look, my ambition is massive, I am not here to be passive. I am not here for you.
Kadesh Flow, what are we hearing?
The whole concept of this song, I actually wanted to start it out in a way that sounded a little bit like an 8-bit intro or 16-bit intro, to your point about it sounding like a video game. But this song is about being in awe of the fact that we're in this place playing these huge festivals, these huge conventions around the country, and we're excited that we kind of broke through this glass ceiling that I was just talking about. And it would take some going in the depth to, because there's a lot of nuance there, but it's nice to be in that position. But it's also talking a little bit about how it's ridiculous that there was even a ceiling that needed to be broken through. So it's kind of a excitement celebration, but admonishing and talking about an issue at the same time sort of song.
How did you get into tech?
Me, really, I've always kind of been into it. I had to step away from trying to become a programmer to focus on my development as an artist when I was in college. So I just left it, and I'm still trying to get back, or saying I'm going to get back into it. But then I ended up working on my MBA and focusing on analytics and marketing, market research, and moving into Cerner on the healthcare IT side and being somewhat of a sales and consultant support sort of person. So it's always kind of been linked, like all the worlds that I've really been interested in, music, tech, gaming, anime, it's all kind of been linked by a pretty thin thread. It's really fascinating that I've kind of been able to bring it together musically, in a sense.
Did the impression that it was a very white kind of space, did that intimidate you in any way or create some kind of stumbling block as you were developing your early interests?
No. So as problematic as some situations tend to be, I tend to view them from a lens of humor for the most part. I don't know if that's a defense mechanism because otherwise they'd be infuriating. But I grew up in the bottom of Alabama. I went to mostly white school, went to mostly white college. So that's very familiar territory to me. So it wasn't really intimidating. I think recognizing that I have a voice and that my voice helps somebody is something that I had to step into, and that was a little bit more of a process.
Well, let's listen to another song. I want to play another track from Room Service that sounds really different from the other one we just heard. This one's called Resolutions, and it's more like, I don't know, melodic and flowing. There's like a groove. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is Resolutions from Kadesh Flo's Room Service.
Dash. Yeah. Yeah. Wasting time checking my DMs. New year, but new me isn't what I'm seeing. Task dodging persists. Folks gassing me in my inbox, I forgot they exist. Their compliments reminding me how they thought I should quit. Popping their lips when I was cracking books and they were rapping songs they thought would be hits. Saying that none of them worked out would be too heavy-handed. I think you understand me. They see the tour photos and crowds and think I'm falling now. They don't know my bank account is bottomed out. Was financially stable, then I quit the job. Didn't stop, but budgeting is the problem now. They don't know that every show dollar I'm running through it. Catching up on bills that stack when I first tried to run with music. Testing patience of a couple homies, I owe money to them. On the book, people posted happy thoughts. Status all attested to a resolution. Mine is always the same, make the best improvements. Be consistent, but trying to improve my execution. Be undeniable, but don't let them detect the
Kadesh, I really dig this song. Tell me, this is sounds very autobiographical.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about this entire process was MAGFest is at the beginning of the year, very beginning, January 5th, I think is when it was. So I'm thinking about the new year a lot. This song in particular, I was writing about resolutions because I really don't like them. And I feel very strongly that constant elevation, which I say at the end of the song, really should be the only goal that people have. So I'm writing about that from a lens of even thinking about how people who dissed me for rapping about anime and video games are now in my inbox, either for collab purposes or gassing me up. And just it just happened. So I was just musing over literally an in-the-moment situation.
I want to back up, though. Tell me more about people insulting you for rapping about anime.
Well, I think it's everyone I associate with has some level of story about this. I wasn't really bullied or anything. I've always was really social, and I had cousins who either played football or kind of people nobody wanted to mess with in high school, so I didn't get messed with. But people knew me as a good musician. I was all-state trombone player. I had a band in college that did really well around town, and when I started doing this, people were like, "What are you doing, man? Like, you do real music. This isn't real." That whole situation. And it kind of was fascinating to me that people would do that, because I'm a guy who's kind of succeeded at everything I've done, even in the midst of failure. You know, I always climb up if I fall down and knock through brick walls. And I've done all this. My resume is awesome from a college standpoint. And, you know, it's just interesting that people would doubt that the decision I was making was something I just really loved and was doing because I loved doing it.
You know, what does appeal to you? What do you love about it that maybe these other people weren't understanding?
The fact that I could be authentic about something I care about and put it in verse in a way that relates to my life. So what's interesting about, especially things with anime, role-playing video games, is if there's a lot of character development that you can superimpose yourself into. And so there are people who grew up and these games got them through things, especially people who maybe weren't as social, who really, really relate to the music I'm making. And I just really enjoyed making it. You know, I mean, not to oversimplify it, but.
And you were going to make the music about things that are authentically part of your life, anime or video games being among those.
Yeah, absolutely. So some stuff is just about my life, which this song is more like that. But some stuff I'm literally rapping about Final Fantasy or Skyrim or something.
But this is interesting in that, you know, you were talking earlier about the quote unquote nerd community not seeing like rap and things like that as nerdy enough. And then you're talking in some ways about the rap community not seeing video games as cool enough.
Yeah, there's a line from Drake, Drake's song from a couple albums ago, where he says, "They made fun of me because I'm black, but now I'm in rap and I'm not black enough." And that it's a similar sort of vibe. You're kind of in between. I wouldn't say a rock and a hard place, but everybody, not everybody, but people want to put an identity on you. Just like anything else, it's not exclusive to this community or this subgenre or anything. But people want to put an idea, identity on you, put parameters on what you should be doing. And you're just out here being you and trying to be great and be the best you that you can be. That's kind of the situation that I find myself in. And it's not necessarily, you know, this is very celebratory. The whole project is celebratory, but I'm dealing with specific things that I think sounds a bit admonishing. So it's kind of, I guess there's a duality there.
You know, take me to the hotel room, just how this worked to record an EP in a hotel room and to do that with so many different elements. I mean, it does seem like there's some high-tech production going on.
Yeah. What happened in this situation was the first song I started writing was Resolutions. I wrote it the night before the flight to D.C.
The song we just heard.
Yes. And I hit up the people I was rooming with. So kind of a big sister for me who's in the Nerdy People of Color Collective. She was main stage in MAGFest. I was playing with her. I had some stuff. I was rooming with her and her husband and her producer, Bill Beats, who actually made that beat. And I said, hey, I'm writing. I've got a lot of ideas. Maybe we should just vibe out in the hotel room and see what happens. Atlas, another producer I worked with, was going to drive up from Atlanta. He just brought his mic. So we just kind of, we had everything there because I alerted everybody last minute that I might be ready to do something. And everybody was down to do it. So it was really beautiful. I think after that, so there are some things that I didn't do, like the progression song Resolutions part two. I didn't want to make anybody angry in a hotel room, so I waited till I got home.
I was wondering about that. I mean, who's in the hotel room next door as an album is being recorded live?
Yeah, most of the stuff was fine, but the trombone stuff, I waited till I got back to Kansas City just to... You know, it's a kind of a loud, obnoxious instrument. And that beat is entirely trombone, with the exception of, I think, one pad and some drums.
Did you have to do anything to outfit the hotel room for this project?
No, we really didn't do anything. That's the kind of incredible part with how it sounds. And thankfully, Desmond Mason, great keys player, part of Soul Revival in Kansas City, I asked him last minute to master the project, literally right before South by Southwest. And mind you, South by Southwest was... March 13th through 20th, and this came out on March 30th. So
that's amazing. Well, how is the project being received so far?
I think it's been really, really good, kind of surprising and humbling, considering the fact that I decided last minute to release it. I sent it to DistroKid while I was in Austin in the middle of a bunch of shows because I just wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. That being said, no marketing behind it. It's had a pretty good reception. People want to talk about it. People are writing about it. I'm very appreciative of that.
Kadesh Flo is a local rapper and trombone player. You might have seen him last weekend with Brass and Bougie opening up for Janelle Monae. When we spoke back in April, he'd just released a new album, Room Service. I'm Gina Kaufman. There's more Central Standard coming right up. Stay tuned. Soccer is a really popular sport in Kansas City now, and we're good. Sporting KC has a spot in the playoffs this season. There are tons of recreational leagues for adults, for kids, but that was not always the case. Our producer, Suzanne Hogan, recently researched how soccer began in Kansas City. It's a story that her family actually had a part in.
Hola.
Hola, ¿cómo estás?
Muy bien, ¿usted?
The history of soccer in Kansas City lives in these two men.
Salvador Gomez, I'm 74 years old. Yo jugué de defensa y de portero.
Armando Diaz, I'm 82 years old, and I play defense and goalie.
Gomez and Diaz are both originally from Mexico. They played together on a team in Kansas City called Los Latinos back in the 1950s. Actually, so did my grandpa, Jose Portuguez, who is from Costa Rica.
¿Es su abuelo?
Sí.
Oh, no sabía. Ah. ¿Cómo está él?
Muy bien.
Jose Portuguez, he was one of our coaches, as a matter of fact, him and Chino Medina.
Chino Medina has since passed away. He was a professional player for the Mexican national team. But as his son Chris Medina remembers, things were a lot different when he came here.
He was just Joe Blow from, or Juan Hernandez from Kansas City, from Mexico, people, yeah, they didn't know who he was or his status.
But to Los Latinos, Chino Medina was a big deal.
They were like blown away. It's like one of the former Royals going to play for, you know, a local baseball team.
Medina says Los Latinos team grew out of a local Catholic church that many Latino immigrants attended.
It was called Guadalupe. That was the first Latino soccer team. They were co-sponsored by the church, Our Lady Guadalupe Church.
And now, Chris Medina works as the executive director for the Guadalupe Center, a Latino social service organization that has roots in that same church.
Where you could find pockets of immigrants, you were going to find soccer, because that was their national pastime.
Los Latinos would get together regularly on Sundays. They played at Gage Park on the west side, and then eventually Gillam and Swope Park. That's where some of the first soccer fields were in the city. Goalposts were made out of plumbing pipes and 2x4s. Salvador Gomez and Armando Diaz remember it well.
They thought we were crazy when we started kicking the ball.
Diaz says in those early years, most people in Kansas City didn't know much about the game.
Well, they used to call it kickball. I said, no, that's not kickball, that's football.
As Los Latinos' team grew, another team formed, Los Internacionales, which was a team made up of European immigrants from Germany, France, Hungary, Croatia. The two teams would play each other regularly and had a healthy rivalry, but both teams faced the same challenges.
When we first started, there was no uniforms here. I went to Mexico to pick up the first uniforms for the international. El emblema y todo lo mandamos a hacer en México, porque aquí no había nada. No había balones, no había nada.
Wait, so you had to go to Mexico
and bring balls and uniforms. There was nothing here, nothing.
And out of humble beginnings, strong connections were formed.
It was in a foreign country, and the Europeans didn't speak English either, and we didn't speak English. So the only thing that kept us together was the little ball right there. It's kicking the ball, because that's the only language that we knew.
Chris Medina was just a kid in those early years, but he remembers how those connections spread regionally.
There was a soccer club made up of Polish people in Des Moines. I remember going to Omaha, and there was a German team there. And in Wichita, there was another Mexican team. So I remember taking those trips that they would go to those cities and they would come to Kansas City and play here.
These were excursions that working people with families organized in their spare time out of the love of the game. And it wasn't long before kids like Chris Medina himself started playing and more teams were organized.
They don't have the history of soccer documented very well in this city, just like they do for the Negro League museums and baseball. Well, there's a rich history here of soccer and people need to know about it.
And though there's no museum documenting it, soccer has become one of Kansas City's most popular sports today, thanks to the early work of Los Latinos. For KCUR 89.3, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to listen back to an interview I did in January with my friend and colleague, CJ Janavi. She had just published a book about the fight for LGBT rights in Kansas. Resistance to that fight could be oppressive, and the people on the front lines faced real consequences. And I just want to say, this is history, but we're not talking about olden times. It's 21st century history. Since this interview originally aired, CJ's book has gotten a lot of attention, and she's still out giving talks about No Place Like Home, Lessons in Activism from LGBT Kansas. Let's hear the story. Hi, CJ.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
The germ of the idea for this book came to you on June 26, 2013. Tell me about that day and what it was like for you.
June 26, 2013 was a Wednesday. And so a lot of people are probably, this weird moment is going to get lost to history probably. But let me jump forward to June 26, 2015, which was the day that the U.S. Supreme Court declared gay marriage, same-sex marriage, legal throughout the country, and everybody could get married in all 50 states. 2 years before that, same day, June 26th.
Weird.
There were two other Supreme Court decisions, one about Proposition 8 in California and another one about the great Edie Windsor's case, which overturned the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. So what happened was those two decisions in 2013 legalized same-sex marriage in some states, but not, you know, 20, 30 states that had passed constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage a decade earlier. So it was just this weird, uneven legal landscape.
And you experienced that landscape here in Kansas City, but you were also noticing how your experience compared with sort of the national...
Yeah, there was a little rally that afternoon downtown at Ilis Davis Park. And, you know, a couple hundred of my LGBT brothers and sisters gathered there after work. And, you know, there were speeches, a little combo from the Mid-America Freedom Band played. Here Comes the Bride, I think. And I was just, you know, there's news reports that night that said everybody's celebrating and this is a historic moment, but it doesn't change anything for those of us who live in these states. Missouri had banned same-sex marriage. Kansas had banned same-sex marriage. And so we were celebrating this huge historic thing that had nothing, that didn't apply to us. And I thought, this is very, very weird. And I want to somehow tell everyone how weird that feels.
So that weird feeling took you to Kansas.
Yes.
For pretty extensive reporting over a period of years.
Yeah.
What was it that the fight in Kansas particularly said to you?
So in the summer of 2013, I was not working as a journalist. I had worked as a journalist for many years in Kansas City and at The Pitch, as you know.
Yes, and, you were my boss there.
And in 2004 and 2005, when Missouri and Kansas were banning gay marriage, you and your colleagues and myself, we had all reported on that. And, you know, flash forward to 2013, I was not working in journalism, but I knew that, you know, I'd been reading the papers. I knew that activists in Kansas had been accomplishing things. And so I wanted to know what became of them. And I clearly needed to do some reporting. So this was, you know, this was like sort of on my free time, very early mornings, all weekends. And I just found people and talked to them. And I started hearing these incredible stories.
They are incredible stories. And I have to say, they can be really brutal. Like, if people are looking for a really sunny picture of activism, there are triumphs here, you know, and people do make progress, as you point out. But the path to get there is really devastating for a lot of these people.
Activism is hard. It requires a lot of work. It requires a certain mindset. It requires toughness. And I think a lot of people are now finding that out in a political time in our country that's inspired a lot of people to become activists. I think what's instructive about this book is you have to really take the long view. You have to keep trying. And the stories in here sort of range from people whose lives were ruined to a young woman who started the Gay Straight Alliance at Hutchinson High School and is so generally comfortable in her life in Hutchinson that she didn't even really know about the same-sex marriage fight a few years before she was in high school.
So let's lay the political foundation for the moment when this overarching narrative of the book begins.
Yes.
There are two simultaneous things happening. One is that there's a handful of people working to get LGBT protections written into state statutes. But then while they're focused on that, they're kind of blindsided by a proposed amendment to the state constitution banning gay marriage.
Well, the gay marriage stuff, I think, is the thing in 04 and 05. This was not some of my colleagues, compatriots in gay rights movement world might disagree with this, but I would argue that gay marriage in the mid-2000s was not a cause that was a priority for the LGBT movement in general. The LGBT movement in general in those days, really, people didn't want to get discriminated against. They wanted not to get fired from their jobs. They wanted not to get kicked out of their apartments. They wanted access to the same public accommodations everybody has. They didn't want to get beat up and killed. So it was really sort of a Karl Rove type led movement politically to get conservative politicians elected. This whole same-sex marriage scare was a way to drive social conservatives to the polls. And so there wasn't a group of people in Kansas who was really sort of ready to defend itself.
So in Kansas, the people who emerged did so kind of organically, as they emerged as leaders based on their own experiences.
There's a small handful of people who are like, wow, the state legislature's trying to get gay marriage banned, and this is going to hurt us. It's going to hurt our communities. And there's like just two or three people who are like, okay, well, we need to do something about this. And so they sort of call a meeting at Washburn University, and they fight it as best they can, but they know they're going to lose. And, you know, 70% of Kansas voters banned same-sex marriage in 2005.
There is this, you detail some of the sort of like conversations and back rooms that people are having, or like moments where particularly a woman named Tiffany Moeller mm-hmm. is forging connections and making allies and doing so very quietly and very methodically. And some of the support that she finds is really surprising.
She finds support everywhere in the sort of hallways of the Kansas State Capitol. People, you know, sort of lobbyists come up and whisper to her and say, you should go talk to so-and-so. In those days, there were still moderate Republicans in the Kansas legislature, and particularly in the Kansas Senate. And there were some real heroes in the state legislature back in those days. There's a former state representative named John Ballou, who she went to talk with. And, you know, she was sort of scared, thinking John Ballou's like the most conservative, flannel wearing, you know, whiskey drinking, like, is, as I remember, she describes him. And, you know, she went to see him, and he tells me in the book, there's no place in the Constitution where it says you get to discriminate against a group of people.
Or take a right away. I remember reading that passage, and, you know, that I think he put it as a question to her. Show me a place in the Constitution where a right is taken away. And she says, I can't do that. And I think he says, I was afraid you were going to say that.
Thank you for your careful reading, Gina. Thank you for remembering that. That's exactly the passage.
It feels like this is the kind of thing that people kind of hope to see in politics, these moments of people coming from different places, but understanding something about how our government is supposed to work and uniting around that. But in spite of all these moments like that one, there's still this crushing defeat.
And then there's another crushing defeat, and then there's two or three more, and then they start having victories.
Yeah, I mean, can we talk a little bit, though, about the defeat, the series of defeats? Because
yes.
It gets at, you know, what made this fight different in Kansas? You know, you mentioned early on in the book that there aren't national organizations throwing money at this movement in Kansas. Why not?
Because it was clearly not a good opportunity for return on investment. I mean, if you're a national organization, and you see, you know, just strategically looking at your resources, which are limited, where are you going to get the most return for you know, the donations that your organization has? And, you know, clearly in Kansas, you're going to lose. That's the thinking anyway. So that's what happened with the marriage amendment. But then out of that defeat, which is crushing, and the activists who were involved sort of, you know, fought among themselves, and that was very painful about what their strategy was going to be. They all met afterwards, and several of them, you know, they all had a bunch of different organizations. They joined together. There is a statewide LGBT advocacy organization called Equality Kansas. It exists to this day. It has chapters in cities around the states. There's another organization specifically in Manhattan called the Flint Hills Human Rights Project. These organizations sort of grew out of that defeat. And then the way I like to say it is they asked for more fights. They went to, in Manhattan, the Flint Hills Human Rights Project did this, and in Salina and Hutchinson, Equality Kansas went to their city hall and asked their city commission to pass ordinances protecting them from discrimination. And those became very dramatic events in those cities in 2011 through 2012, 2013. And those were a whole additional set of fights, and those were all losing also.
You know, it seems like part of what leads to the point of unity within this movement, part of the struggle to get there, is also that in Kansas, people in general are spread out, and then there's like this really increased isolation of these individual players in their separate communities dispersed through this sparsely populated, in many regions, state.
It's a beautiful state to drive around. I went to some of these super rural isolated places, and you know, I mean, I think that's one of the landscape of Kansas is one of the things everybody loves about the state. One of the reasons people care about it so much and stay and want to stay.
There's also this idea, you point out that the state's capital, Topeka, is known for two things that represent two sides of the state's political personality: Brown versus Board of Education and the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yes.
Talk about that.
if one wanted to make, I don't know, a rich, schizophrenic, significant type of civil rights pilgrimage to Topeka, one could go visit the Brown versus Board of Education historic site, which is the site of the old Monroe School, which I've done. It's a really, you know, it's a great tourist place that not many people know about. And then when one could go over and visit the Phelps compound near Gage Park and across the street, people do make pilgrimages to the Equality House and the which is the rainbow painted house across the street from the Phelps compound. And then right next to that, there's also the, I think it's called the Capital City for Transgender Equality. I apologize if I'm mixing that name up a little bit, but it's painted one house. There are these little ranch homes. One's painted in rainbow colors and the other one's painted in the sort of light blue and pink of the transgender flag.
What does this all say to you about Kansas and what it means, what words like rights and equality mean in Kansas?
Kansas has a long history of those words. I mean, it's hard to sort of say one thing. I mean, think back to the founding of the state and the free state thing. And I think that there's just the activism is certainly there were loud moments of it, of, you know, rallies at the Capitol and that kind of thing. But also there are very quiet moments of people talking to their parents, people talking to their kids, their neighbors, their churches, and I think that one theme that came up a lot was just people respecting each other and people having this belief in hard work and live and let live and individuality and that those values.
CJ Janovy, hang on with me through the break, okay?
Yeah.
When we return, some of the human stories behind the fight for LGBT rights in Kansas. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with CJ Janovy, author of No Place Like Home, Lessons in Activism in LGBT Kansas. Some of the personal stories in this book just absolutely blew my mind. Like, I really am sort of obsessed with the story of Sandra Stenzel. It is so intense.
Sandra Stenzel is a wonderful woman who lives in Trigo County, which is 5 hours west of here. The main town there is Waukini. And Sandra grew up there on a farm. Her Volga German ancestors homesteaded a piece of property in Trigo County in 1915, and she was just a farmer in her blood, grew up farming, went to 4-H, was a really sort of classic Kansas farm girl, went to college at Fort Hays State and realized she had a affinity for budgets and became sort of an economic development professional. And she ended up moving to Texas and running big economic development agencies there. She came back to Trigo County 15 years later, was running the economic development office in Trigo County.
She made a lot of change happen in her little community as the economic development coordinator.
Well, everything's relative. So she was, you know, when you talk about sort of getting money to do new streetscaping in Waukini or a study to build a new nursing home, those kinds of things. And, you know, I think I can't remember the exact statistics, but bringing, you know, 10 new jobs to the county when nobody else did.
But she had this super fun life in Austin before that. She comes back here because, as you said, like the farm is in her blood.
Her dad dies. Her mom's getting older. She had always wanted to come back and live on the farm and work on the farm in Trigo County. So what happens is she gets back about the time of this marriage amendment. She's a Democrat. She's a lifelong Democrat. She goes and meets with some other gay folks in the Democratic world to, you know, the LGBT caucus of the Democratic Party at the time, which is sort of lame. And you know, she's among this small handful of people who fight the amendment. And she takes a day off of work, a vacation day from her job as economic development director in Trigo County, comes to Topeka to testify and talks about how hard it is to bring jobs to Kansas anyway. And if you're perceived as a state that's hostile to LGBT people, it's even harder.
Yeah, she makes an economic development argument,
yes,
against this gay marriage ban, which she does not expect to get a lot of attention. But lo and behold, it's earth shattering.
She wakes up the next morning and, you know, she's the headline in the newspapers all across Kansas. And she immediately begins having trouble there in Waukini and is eventually forced out of her job as economic development director.
And the next 10 years, it sounds like, are just an experience in depression and isolation for
her.
This
is devastating for her because, A, she loves her community so much. And the way that she was forced out was especially devastating because this was very dramatic. There were, you know, the county commission sort of decides to disband the economic development organization. So she loses her job, but not until after two or three massive town hall meetings where everyone, you know, 200 people show up at the state fairgrounds to say, keep Sandra in her job. And she still ends up losing her job. And so she feels, you know, unwelcome suddenly in a place where hard work and a good name, which she had always had, count for a lot. And so she's sort of, yeah, she goes into isolation. She's never again has a full-time job. And
yeah, I kind of want to like go back in time and tell the woman leaving Austin, like, are you sure?
Right.
And which is, yeah, that brings up, and I want to get to her comeback, but uh-huh, it brings up, I think, an important question, which is that there are people fighting this brave fight, mm-hmm, making these sacrifices to be who they are and be those people where they're from. But, I mean, it's inspiring, the level of commitment to a place, but is it worth it?
I think that Sandra would say that having her story told at this point might have made it worth it. And I think that
you're just a person who was part of this fight and part of this change.
Yes. And I think that this is one of the things about activism and why it's important to keep the long view is that there's always another fight and things change over time. And one of the big things that I think this story shows is, you know, when you think about just polls and attitudes toward same-sex marriage in 2004, the majority of Americans were against it. By 2015, when it was legal, the majority of Americans were totally for it. And how did that change in perception come? It came partly because LGBT people were out there fighting for marriage equality, but it also came about because so many people, like Sandra Stenzel and like so many of the other folks in the book, were talking to their communities and their friends and their colleagues and their coworkers about who they really were, and it opened people's minds.
Yeah, talk to me about Luann Call.
Luann Call is another person who grew up on a farm in Iowa, was Leonard Call, and struggled through into middle age with knowing that there was something that felt very wrong, and ended up moving to getting a job to run a woman's farm in Haven, Kansas, and comes to Kansas, realizes that she needs to be Luann, begins a gender transition while working as a farmhand in Haven, which is south central Kansas, not too far from Hutchinson. Then gets another, saves this woman's farm, kind of gets told she needs to leave when it becomes clear that she's really undergoing a gender transition. Moves farther west to Calvesta, which is another place that was very far away and hard to get to. Manages cattle, goes through this transition and joins a small handful of other activists out in southwest Kansas to start a chapter of Equality Kansas in Dodge City.
There are people also in this book who are more part of like the college town scene in Lawrence. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really diverse group of people. But before we go, I do want to give you a chance to tell us about how defeat does give way to progress, what that means to you.
Work. Keep working. Keep working. Prepare to lose. Roll up your sleeves and go to work.
What does the progress look like in this book?
In this book, it takes different forms for lots of different people in this book. And for me, it really gets back to that young woman who started the Gay-Straight Alliance at Hutchinson High School in 2014. And I sat in, her name's Kara Vaughn. I sat in a coffee shop with her and realized that all of these people had made a much better world for her to inherit.
CJ Janovy is the author of No Place Like Home, Lessons in Activism from LGBT Kansas. Her next event is November 18th at the Delta Athenaeum on Linwood Boulevard. This time she's giving a talk titled How to Win Hearts and Minds by Losing. We'll link to the event page when we post the audio from this show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That'll be up later today. You can also check out highlights from the week. Yesterday, we talked about how poverty affects menstrual periods. It's an under-discussed public health issue and a serious one. We also had some more lighthearted conversations. If you missed our interview with the artist known as AY, who's giving a battery-powered concert at Open Spaces this weekend, that's a fun one for sure. kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. We had contributions this week from Michelle Tyreen Johnson and the crew at the Kansas News Service. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.